You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Look, I have to start by saying I can already tell that the comment section is going to be elated for this catch up, because this is the first one where you actually have a mic.
Yeah, I got a lot of feedback on that. And so, yeah, the Mrs. FFTT was finally, she took care of me here. So I've got a very, it's apparently a good one. I wouldn't know if it's a good one. Well, it's the same one you've got, so it must be good. So yeah, it's here. So that's good.
It's the sound quality is impeccable. And I think it's important that it's impeccable for this update, because as you were just saying, the world is getting crazier. And I think we had a stark reminder of how crazy and volatile it can get, at least in markets, over the last 96 hours with Trump's Friday Truth Social post that sent markets into a tizzy. And then predictable, I recorded on Friday with somebody right after the post went out. And I said, okay, well, we can expect a post on Sunday morning or afternoon, sort of backing off from his statements. And that's exactly what happened. For those who are unaware, Trump came out and said that we're going to put 100% tariffs on China's rare earth metals because they weren't cooperating in negotiations. And then Sunday said, hey, President Xi was just not in a good state of mind. We're back into a good spot. What is this geopolitical volatility signal to you?
I think it signals that China has a lot more leverage than a lot of the Western commentators are admitting. And maybe this might have been the first time where they finally admitted, reading between the lines. I think China retaliated for the latest semiconductor, high-end semiconductor related sanctions. And basically my view was like, all right, well, you're not going to be allowed to have this stuff. That was the initial read. And it's interesting. Trump came out with what they said, with what he said Friday, right? Which is 100% tariffs and, you know, markets threw a fit. And then the Chinese came out and clarified either a Saturday or Sunday. I don't remember exactly when it was, and it was kind of like the most Chinese statement ever. It was like, you know, this is not a ban, which, you know, in my experience is, you know, is it a ban or is it not a ban? You know, one of my best sources on China, a friend of mine, goes, is it a ban or is it not a ban? Yes, that's the answer. That's how the Chinese negotiate. So, but when you really read what they said, apparently it's about the weapons. You know, it's a ban on weapons. We're not going to supply rare earths to the U.S. Defense Department to make weapons to point missiles at us and our friends anymore. And, you know, the rest of, and it was interesting because the U.S. spun it as, hey, they're shutting everybody off. And the Chinese said, no. And so then there was, you know, Trump tacoed, or China backed or de-escalated. It spun as mutual de-escalation, which it was. And I think there is still not the recognition. There was a moment of recognition in the West of, oh my gosh, they can shut down everything, which, yeah, we've known that all along. If you were honest, you know, if people are honest about the things, and not that wouldn't hurt them too, it would. But I think the most important thing is they're done selling weapons to the U.S. Defense Department. They're done selling selling rare earths into weapon system for the U.S. Defense Department, which is enormous. And I think still not fully digested, you know, might be being digested by the gold market this morning, which is up $110 as we speak, over $4,100 on the futures. But that's got a lot more to go, in my opinion, to properly digest that message. So, I think it's really important in terms of what just transpired, because it's they're basically saying we're done selling rare earths into Western defense systems. You know, get your own rare earths.
Yeah, it seems like China feels like it is in a good position. It seems like there's been some coordinating in the background to get to this point where they feel confident to plant these flags in the ground and draw these lines in the sand, if you will. And it pertains to the gold market, particularly what they've been doing with the Shanghai Exchange, putting the gold on warrant. And it seems like I had a conversation with Vince Lancey on Friday, and he made a really good point, is like they're essentially setting up this parallel settlement network that settles in gold. And it seems like the last 6 to 8 months have really been greasing the wheels, getting the slopes ready for that. It's on, and now they can posture geopolitically from a position of strength.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you know, historically, if you messed with the monetary side of the rules-based global order, U.S. would send the military over and kick your head in. Like that's that had a big part of why Saddam was invaded, a big part of what Gaddafi was doing, as we know from Hillary's emails once upon a time. And the Chinese have been doing this. And so they've seen the message, which is when we try to change, which they have to, because, again, they're not doing it because they hate us. They're doing it because they will literally have a late 1990s Southeast Asia crisis where China collapses like you saw Southeast Asia do if they don't do this. And so they have understood the order of operations, which is if we're going to do this, we need to make it impossible for the U.S. to come over here and kick our heads in. And that's what this is about. And to me, the rare earth card being played in April or May, whenever that was, and we wrote about it at the time, is essentially we're done selling rare earths to the U.S. military. And that was my interpretation of it then. This institutionalized it. This is basically, it's now in black and white. And if that's the case, then the window's wide open for the system to be reset. And I think sort of, you know, number 1A on the list of symptoms that you would see as the system is reset in a manner that China, Russia, the BRICS would like is, I think you'll come in and you'll see the price of gold up on every day that ends in Y. And that's what we've been seeing over the last, you know, month or so. Today, no exception. So, I think it's a huge deal. You know, I do think that, you know, Trump with his tweets, when he tweets impulsively or posts impulsively, he usually gives you something that he probably shouldn't either, or that, you know, that is incremental information. So last week, just some very serious people saying, hey, we're hearing Xi had a stroke. We're hearing Xi's being deposed. Well, Trump just told you that Xi had a bad day and made a mistake. So Xi didn't have a stroke and did not get deposed per the president of the United States and his post. And then the other thing is we have heard chapter and verse from Trump, Bessent, Lutnick over and over about how we have all the leverage. That post just told us, no, we don't. Now, again, that's not a surprise per se, but that takes us from denial the denial stage of grief about who actually has what level of relative leverage into somewhere between anger and bargaining, right? It's, you know, he threw his fit. Then he's like, well, it'll be, you know, we don't want to put China in a depression and we don't want to put ourselves in a depression. That's exactly right. We put them both in a depression. So, you know, let's de-escalate. But again, I think it masks like the number one key thing, which is we got to find our own rare earths for our own weapon systems.
Yeah. It's either that or, because I had somebody who's very well versed on China, has lived over there for 30 years, an American. And I asked him, like, what is the solution to this? And it's the U.S. and China gets to the table, and the U.S. basically acknowledges that China is an equal, apparently, from a social perspective, from a cultural perspective. That's what China wants most, just to be viewed as an equal. And I think with the leverage you just described that China has over us, that may be sort of the necessary pride swallowing that needs to happen to try to figure this out moving forward.
Yeah, I think it ends up being a really good thing for the world if you know, the two big powers stop fighting. And, you know, there's a version of this that can go really well, a version that can go really badly. But I you know, and again, it's not to say China won't be hurt by this. China would be hurt by that as well. The challenge is that, like, we know the Treasury market will blow up in 5 to 7 days, trading days, if there's a hard divorce. Whereas China probably would be able to hunker down and be all right for 5 to 7 months. You know, and we know that empirically because we saw it happen in April. Treasury market after Liberation Day went exactly 7 trading days. And then, you know, that led to the first Trump taco. So it's all about that sort of relative dynamic. We also know from May and June, after 11 days of medium intensity combat, the U.S. chewed through 15% of its high-end air defense missiles, defending Israel from Iranian drones. And, you know, we've also heard that, you know, the Chinese can produce 4,000 cruise missile motors a week, which compares to 6,000, roughly, reportedly, Tomahawk cruise missiles in inventory total. So they can produce our entire inventory every week and a half in a very automated, in very automated fashion. So, and with rare earths, those supplies would be run, you know, would be run down even faster. So there is a, all supply chain bottlenecks are not equal, right? You can look at, you know, what's our GDP, what's their GDP, whatever. Those metrics are interesting. But in the end, in things like this, it's all about the marginal metric, right? Think about this. There was a headline in FT yesterday saying the U.S. Defense Department is out buying $1 billion worth of critical minerals. People are like, wow, that's like 4 times what we use every year. We're good. But I think that misses the message. 1 billion of critical minerals, 250 million a year of critical minerals of inputs, which the removal of that shuts down $1 trillion a year military, most powerful military in the world, right? It's like the old poem, you know, for want of a nail, right? For want of a nail. And it's the nail in this case is the critical minerals.
Yeah. Well, moving this back to gold with the price going up too, it was another interesting thing that Vince Lancey brought up during our conversation on Friday, was that there's a lot of people in the Western pundit space, particularly FinTwit, that believes in the dollar milkshake theory, that everything will fail up into the dollar in the U.S. Treasury market. But this situation in the gold market is particularly creating this parallel settlement network via Shanghai Gold Exchange and other BRICS nations spinning up their vaults, really throws a wrench in that thesis, which is that can potentially not happen if you have this alternative settlement network that people can leverage. And do you think the price going up 110 today, I mean, many people are focusing on China specifically, but I think everybody in the geopolitical landscape is looking at what's happening right now and saying, okay, I got to get some gold. I got to get some silver. There's apparently a silver shortage going on right now. And I don't know how legitimate that is, but at least the narrative's out there.
Yeah, I think like the Brent milkshake theory is absolutely correct around initially gold going up with the dollar. Something I posted a long time ago on X, and people familiar with the FOFOA blog and the readings of monetary theorist another and friend of another will recall that in the late 1990s, another or friend of another said that when the dollar system is coming to the end of its life, you will see the dollar and gold rise together. That will be the sign that the dollars, because people will be getting squeezed into the dollar at one hand, but they'll also be getting out and going into gold. And so when those two things are rising together, that's the symptom of the end of the dollar system. That was said 30 years ago, almost 25 years ago. And so, yes, the milkshake theory will see the dollar squeeze higher. I get it. And gold as well. And gold, once it hits critical tipping point of price. And I don't know where that price is, but you can see hints of it. You know, Albert Marco on X has said, hey, above $3,000 on gold, it starts to create a problem for the dollar. He was right. The dollar went down to 96. It says above $5,000 on gold, it creates a problem for the dollar and for the treasury market. He's probably going to be right. And the point here, or what he's saying when he says that, is ultimately, yes, there is this, you know, we've talked about this, you know, $13 trillion dollar denominated liability out there, right? In terms of foreign borrowed dollar debt, that when the dollar goes up, it squeezes people into that. It forces them to sell treasuries. It forces them to sell U.S. equities to raise the dollars to get that. Well, once the price of gold gets high enough, it starts to fully collateralize their dollar liability on the other side. And suddenly, it starts to provide the liquidity. It starts to be the sink. And that is how you circumvent the gold is how you get out of the dollar system. And that's why another or a friend of another said all those years ago, when you see them go up together, that means the dollar is coming to its end of life. This dollar, this present form of this dollar system is coming to the end of life. Now, does it mean the dollar is going to die? No. I'll be using dollars, and you know, you're and my grandkids and great grandkids will still be using dollars. They're just going to buy us a lot less. And certainly in gold terms, de facto, we can see gold with today's price move has overtaken treasuries in global central bank reserves, right? So there's now more gold in global central bank reserves than there are U.S. treasuries. How do you sit there and argue and say, you know, it's not overtaken the dollar in the system? Like, to me, that's crazy. Now, will people still use dollars? Of course. Why? That's just Gresham's law, right? I hear people say, well, it's still dominant. 90% of currency usage, that's dollar dominance. Great. So you're spending, yeah, you're telling me it's the bad currency, right? I'll spend dollars all day long because there's a terrible store of value. But if the whole change of structure we've been talking about for years, and I mean, if you watch, look at all my posts, all my podcasts, everything I've ever said, I've never said end of dollar reserve status. It's end of the post-71 structure of dollar reserve status, which is dollar as primary reserve currency, treasury bond as primary reserve asset. It happened. It's happened. The dollar is still primary reserve currency, but gold is now primary reserve asset as of probably this morning with the $100 move. And I don't think it's ever going back unless, you know, she suddenly decides to be, you know, Yeltsin and, you know, sell off his country for pennies on the dollar to American, you know, corporate and Washington interests. And Putin decides to do the same thing because we can't go to war to stop him. The rare earth thing ensures it.
Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. BitKey makes Bitcoin easy to use and hard to lose. It is a hardware wallet that natively embeds into a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You have one key on the hardware wallet, one key on your mobile device, and Block stores a key in the cloud for you. This is an incredible hardware device for your friends and family, or maybe yourself, who have Bitcoin on exchanges and have for a long time, but haven't taken the step to self-custody because they're worried about the complications of setting up a private public key pair, securing that seed phrase, setting up a PIN, setting up a passphrase. Again, BitKey makes it easy to use, hard to lose. It's the easiest 0-to-1 step, your first step to self-custody. If you have friends and family on the exchanges who haven't moved it off, tell them to pick up a BitKey. Go to bitkey.world, use the key TFTC20 at checkout for 20% off your order. That's bitkey.world, code TFTC20.
Sup, freaks. This rip is brought to you by our good friends at Silent. Silent creates everyday Faraday gear that protects your hardware. We're in Bitcoin. We have a lot of hardware that we need to secure. Your wallet emits signals that can leave you vulnerable. You want to pick up Silent's gear, put your hardware in that. I have a tap signer right here. I got the Silent card holder, replaced my wallet. I was using Ridge Wallet because it's secured against RFID signal jacking. Silent, the card holder, does the same thing. It's much sleeker, fits in my pocket much easier. I also have the Faraday phone sleeve, which you can put a hardware wallet in. We're actually using it for our keys at the house, too. There's been a lot of robberies. They have essential Faraday slings, Faraday backpacks. It's a Bitcoin company. They're running on a Bitcoin standard. They have a Bitcoin treasury. They accept Bitcoin via Strike. So go to slnt.com/TFTC to get 15% off anything, or simply just use the code TFTC when shopping at slnt.com. Patented technology, special operations approved. It has free shipping as well. So go check it out.
I guess, I mean, that begs the question, like, what does the U.S. do in reaction to this? I mean, there was many that were surmising in the beginning of the year, we're calling gold in kind back where we were calling gold from vaults internationally into the U.S., seeing what China was doing and others in preparation. Obviously, there was the Genius Act getting passed here in the United States, and the Trump administration and the advisors around the administration are saying this is how we're going to save the treasury market. We're going to take advantage of the fact that the U.S. dollar is the preferred currency globally and try to flood markets with it, with this new technology in stable coins, and stable coin issuers will have to buy treasuries. But it seems like we've got to also at the same time expedite this reshoring of manufacturing if we want to sort of inoculate ourselves from these external factors.
Yeah. And you know, I think the stable coin thing can work. But let's call it what it is, right? This is like, you know, Operation Iraqi Freedom, right? Well, you know, or, you know, the Affordable Care Act, right? Or, you know, whenever the government names something, you should sort of like assume it's the opposite of what it is, and you're usually closer to the truth. And so let's call the stablecoin gambit for what it is. They should have called it, we can't issue bonds at the long end of the curve in sufficient amounts at prices that don't blow up our debt anymore. So we are issuing and we're refinancing all of our debt in near cash markets. And that's what the stablecoin thing's about. But of course, that doesn't roll off the tongue quite as nicely as the Genius Act, does it? So, but that's what they're doing. They are issuing, they're going to finance, right? And you can see hints of it, right? When you see Bessent come, you know, get sworn in and immediately double the pace of treasury buybacks that Yellen was doing, which only started in, was it May of last year, April of last year? He doubles the pace of treasury buybacks immediately relative to what she was doing. And it is heavily skewed, it's heavily skewed towards issuing short-term paper to replace longer-term paper. So he's bringing in duration. And then I hear credible rumblings that, you know, the plan will eventually be if you can get stable coins big enough, right? If this can work, then you will do some form of what the U.S. did in the 50s, which is make the T-bills that go into stable coins non-marketable and say, they're not 4%. All stablecoin T-bills yield 50 basis points, 30 basis points, whatever. Bessent will have taken control of the short end of the curve from Powell, completely disintermediated him. But we will be financing massive deficits and the cost of reshoring in near cash markets. Now, what would I want to own if Bessent came out and said, we are going to reshore and I'm just going to straight print the money to pay it? What would we see? We'd see gold up, we'd see Bitcoin up, we'd see stocks up. And we might not see the long end of the curve go up, because if he's not issuing any bonds at the long end, there's a mindless bid for duration. This, I don't know if it's $400, $500, $600 billion a year from pensions and liability matching. Like, they have to buy no matter what. And as long as he keeps issuance out there below that number, long end can be relatively well behaved, as we've seen. Doesn't make me want to own it. They're getting killed on a real basis. But if we saw that, that's how we'd react. If he said that, that's what we'd react. Well, stable coins to finance large amounts of the deficit, it's just like the kissing cousin of printing cash to pay for the deficit. Why is it happening? Because it has to. That's where we are in this. Like, there's no mystery. You go through the history books and these great powers that get into debt and have these big you start at the long end and you know, foreigners, and then you stay at the long end and you plug domestic. And then when you run out of that, eventually you end up basically printing money to finance your deficits. And we're not quite there yet, but that's what the stablecoin gambit is. Now, what else can they do? Look, if he can get the price of gold up a lot, you know, at $20,000 an ounce, if they can do things that make the market bid gold to 20,000, and you know, people used to think that was insane, but I got to tell you, at $100 a day, it's looking less insane. You know, 50 to 100 bucks a day moves on the upside is looking a lot less insane than it was, say, 6 months ago. But if he can get it to $20,000 an ounce, which, by the way, would only put it back to 1989, excuse me, it would only put it slightly above the long-term average of gold's price relative to the foreign portion of our debt, the market value of U.S. official gold relative to foreign debt. $20,000 an ounce would deposit roughly $5 trillion into the Treasury General account, free and clear. It's just straight money creation using gold. It's an accounting entry. Wouldn't have to sell any gold, whatever. And then you could buy down a pretty big chunk of debt. You can go out into the market and say, I'm going to, you know, either he can finance the U.S., you know, the long end needs with that $5 trillion for 5 years at least, probably more like 8 years. Or he could just go in and immediately say, hey, I'm going to buy back $5 trillion worth of the $29 trillion out. That's going to take down 20% of the market. So debt to GDP is under 100 right away. Assuming a money multiplier, nominal GDP is probably going to run friggin' 15, 20% for a couple of years. Debt to GDP will be back to 50, 60% in a very short period of time over the backs of, you know, the purchasing power of stablecoin holders around the world. So they could do that, but boy, they got to hurry because, you know, Treasury, you know, interest doesn't sleep.
No, it doesn't. And I was telling you, I've been watching some of your FFTT videos over the last few days, and you were mentioning a book. I forget the name of the book, but author's first name is Tobias, talking about 1931 Germany and the parallels that exist between today and then.
And no, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think you said it in the video, like history doesn't repeat, but it certainly rhymes. And it looks like we have maybe not a playbook, but some history from 100 years ago that we could look at and say, hey, this is what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's fascinating. We between that book and the book Raven of Zurich, the memoirs of Felix Somery, which I own, which is great. You know, there's a great passage from like 1912. Because Somery's writing, a lot of it is his, you know, it's his diary as the world was completely changing, right? Like you came into 1914 with four empires, and by 1908, and those four empires had run the world for like 300 years prior. And within 4 years, three of the four were gone entirely. The fourth was wounded, and the British Empire, you know, had lost 6% of its working age men in the war, you know, had lost its power. Basically, at that point, was a debt vassal of the United States. And so we overtook them as global reserve currency, as global, you know, it was the first step in sort of, you know, becoming the global empire. But it's fascinating. There's this passage where Somery says, you know, Europe, which was full in 1912, full of optimism and pride and power, of looked at the Chinese, you know, in European capitals with curiosity, because they always weighed their money, the silver and the gold. They would weigh it. They didn't go by denomination; they went by weighing it, and they thought the Chinese were five generations behind the Europeans. They thought they were, Somery says, but in reality, they were a generation ahead. They had the experience and the historical memory of inflation under Mongol emperors who'd printed a bunch of paper billions and had to suffer through the consequences. And so that's why the Chinese weighed their silver and gold money in 1912. And the Europeans thought they were, you know, they were hillbillies, thought they were behind when they were actually ahead. Now, stop me when this all starts to sound familiar, right? Like, how often for the last 15 years have we heard how backwards the Chinese are and how they'll never catch up and this and that? Like here we are. The Chinese have been buying gold hand over fist for 15 plus years, 18 years. And what have the American, you know, Wall Street financiers, power, Washington laughed at them? They're not laughing now, are they? They're not laughing at all. I think something similar is going to happen.
Sup, freaks? This was brought to you by our good friends at Obscura. If you've been listening to the show long enough, you know we care deeply about privacy, particularly as you peruse the web. It is important to be using a VPN, and Obscura is our VPN of choice. That is because it is a VPN built by a Bitcoiner for Bitcoiners. It is the first VPN that can't log your activity and outsmarts internet censorship. Obscura VPN works even in the most restrictive Wi-Fi networks where other VPNs simply fail to connect. With server locations across America and the globe, Obscura keeps your internet access unrestricted wherever you are. I've been using it since it launched. I see no problems with speed. I can get on YouTube TV without any problems. It simply works. They can't log. You can pay in Bitcoin. Go to Obscura.net. Use the code TFTC25 for 25% off an annual subscription. It's already a good deal, their annual deal. The TFTC25 code gets you 25% more off. Go check it out. Obscura.net. Use the code TFTC25. Sup, freaks? Healthcare open enrollment has started. It will roll through the end of January. Opt out of traditional health insurance, which doesn't care about you. It's impersonal. It's expensive. They deny increasing amount of claims. Premiums are going up. You don't have to live this way. You can opt out. I opted out 4 years ago and joined CrowdHealth. I've been a CrowdHealth member, a very happy CrowdHealth member for 4 years. I've had two children, a couple of health events in that time period, and CrowdHealth has been there. You pay a monthly fee, you contribute to the crowd. We were paying $1,800 on Cobra as a family of three. Now we're paying around $900 a month as a family of five, and that's with CrowdHealth and direct primary care. You can opt out of health insurance. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. You're going to get $99 a month for the first 3 months if you use the code TFTC. Joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Sup, freaks? This group is brought to you by our good friends at Unchained, and they are holding another live event that you should check out. Markets are choppy. Layoffs are in the headlines. And rate cuts aren't fixing the core problem. That core problem is that the fiat retirement system is taking on water. On October 28th, Mark Moss and Unchained's Jeff Vandrew will explain why 401ks were built to serve the system, not you, and how fees and hidden risk create an illusion of wealth. You'll learn why Bitcoin security and growth curve make it a powerful long-term savings asset, and how a Bitcoin IRA can let you roll over an old 401k with tax advantages intact. If you want a retirement plan that prioritizes sovereignty and purchasing power, this is the event. Register now at unchained.com/TFTC. Unchained.com/TFTC.
And I think the only thing you can call it is hubris, too. Is
that's right. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. But like, not only from a monetary and economic perspective, but from the military perspective, we've been beating our chests like we're the biggest, strongest military that's ever existed on the planet. China will never be able to catch up, but you threw that stat out earlier. They're able to build, 4,000 Tomahawks per week. And
that was, well, not Tomahawks, but that's from David P. Goldman, who's a very good source on this stuff at Asia Times. He wrote 2 or 3 years ago, he said that, you know, that they can reportedly make 4,000 cruise missile motors a week.
Cruise missile motors. But that, yeah. Then you look at the advancements that they've had technologically with automation. I think many people in the United States are looking at the drone technology specifically and saying, oh, that's pretty scary. And you go back to, they own the rare earths, which is the raw input of everything we need. And it's very perplexing that we're still beating our chests in this way and not showing a bit of humility. Like, okay, we messed up. And it does seem like the Trump administration has recognized, holy crap, we're behind in a lot of ways to China. But I think they're focused on energy and AI specifically, which rightly so, I think they should be. But militarily, things aren't looking relatively good for the U.S. right now either as it pertains to China. And it's just like, all right, when are we going to swallow our pride, take the hard medicine and recognize like, hey, we need to show these Chinese some respect because you do not want to go to the kinetic warfare route with them, I don't think. Because Anduril's CEO was on a podcast with the A16Z guys last week, and he was saying, and I think you referenced this into some of the missiles we supplied Israel earlier this year. Like we can, if 5 days worth of depleting missiles in war takes 2 years to build back that supply, which is astonishing to me.
Yeah, there's a great quote from U.S. Marine Corps General Barrow. You know, amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics. And we've been more focused on tactics and they've been arguably more focused on logistics, which we can say because, you know, 2.5 years ago, the CEO of Raytheon was quoted in the Financial Times saying, you know, we literally can't go to war without Chinese components. And it will be many, many years to try to replace that. They know it. who let that happen? Why did that decision happen? You start pulling on that thread, I think you're going to get some really unpleasant conversations, and that gets into politics that, quite frankly, I don't want to be involved in because I, I'll just leave it at that. But the hints have been there. You really said the right word, which is hubris. There's an author, a guy named Andrei Martyanov, who was a former Soviet engineer. I believe he was in the Soviet military when the Soviet Union collapsed. He came here and he advised the U.S. military on all sorts of missile technology, etc. And he began writing some books a few years back, The Real Revolution in Military Affairs. And most recently, he wrote one a year and a half ago that was published called America's Final War. And the overall thrust of these books was, number one, there's very much a science to military. Military sciences, I believe, is a thing. And, you know, you can run a calculation of, okay, how much steel can you produce? How much iron ore can you produce? How much copper can you produce? What is your aggregate BTU output of your energy electrical grid? How many engineers are you graduating a year? What's your manpower? All of these things, you know, can be put together into a calculation that gives you some level of understanding of the ability to prosecute war. It's a measure of power, hard power. And in the first book, he laid out, like, the Russians were so far ahead of the U.S. in that already that it wasn't even close. And I think people, number one, I don't even think he could get it published in the Western press, so he went with an independent publisher. You can buy it on Amazon, to America's credit, right? It's not censored. But you read that, you go, huh, interesting. And then we got a test of that in places like Ukraine, in places like Iran and Israel. And what you find then is what he lays out in America's Final War, which is America doesn't have enough of an industrial base to prosecute a major war. And the industrial base and installed capacity it has is all in the wrong things, because the nature of war has changed, right? Think about what technology and AI do. They allow smaller, less well-capitalized participants to do things just as good with just as broad a reach as big capital. You and I are sitting here talking. You know, I was laughing, the whole Jimmy Kimmel thing. Like, I was looking at his numbers. Like, I have podcasts that have better numbers than he was getting every night. I'm like, what? Like, look at the commercial, the new Apple iPhone commercial, right? What do they have? They have an iPhone in a case with real filmmakers using it to film. This is what technology high-level. And this is what Andrei Martyanov was saying, is like, the Americans have all of this sunk cost into these weapons platforms that aren't the right weapons platforms. They're not going to fare well in war. Eric Prince, a former CEO of Blackwater, said it back in February in a speech. He said, if we sailed a carrier group over to Taiwan to try to blockade it, we would see it on the news, smoking or worse. Because it has changed, the nature of warfare has changed. Drones, hypersonic missiles, etc. And they've known this for at least, first time I heard about it was in 2018 at a private conference, which means they've known about this for at least 10 years, at least, and probably more. But the political reality, right, like the Philadelphia shipyards, right, historically a big naval shipyard. There's a bunch of ships being built there, or that in theory could be built there, that aren't the right things to build anymore, right? But you're going to go to the senator from Pennsylvania and go, we're going to shut down the Philly shipyards and turn it into some sort of missile works or drone works? Come on. That's not how this country works. And that's the challenge, is there's this inertia around the installed base where the incumbent has a disadvantage. And that's what we've been watching.
Yeah, the Philadelphia Navy Yard, it's the headquarters of Anthropology now, which is one of the favorite stores of
oh, is that right?
Upper middle class white women in the United States. But it's a far cry from where it was
That might be the perfect metaphor for why we can't go to war. we used to make destroyers there, and now we outfit
cute dresses. It's cute dresses now. Well, with this in mind, I think there has been a recognition. A lot of people have their thoughts about the sort of Silicon Valley tech elite, but I think if you look at companies like Anduril, and there is a big focus on providing startup capital to industrial base focused companies. There was a company named Base that just spun up a factory in the center of Austin, in the old Austin, the Austin Times factory right on Congress Ave that shut down. Obviously, Anduril's focused on drone technology and anti-drone technology. There's a sort of metal fabricating startup that's based out of Michigan. So it seems like at least some part of the investment class here in the United States recognizes that we have this weakness in the private markets trying to solve these problems. Like on that note, like what, if anything, are we doing right now? And where do you think we should be focusing sort of deploying capital to fix these problems?
Well, it's interesting. I was just, I think those things are the right thing to do. And I think we also need to be subsidizing in a major way metallurgy trades, metallurgy degrees, rare earth refining degrees, which doesn't even really exist in America. I'm told 33 different Chinese universities have them. America has zero. Engineering degrees, skilled trades should all be being subsidized majorly. In other words, like you don't pay to go to school and, you come out and you're going to be making, I don't know, more than a first year, more than a third year Wall Street banker, something like that, right? Guaranteed by the U.S. government. Because you've got to get the labor there. There's, as an American, why would I go like study really hard, not get to drink a bunch of beer when I could go into, finance and come out and trade crypto and make way more money than someone who's actually helped build stuff? And I say this with being one of those guys that went to college and made the choice in 1993 to drink a bunch of beer and not have to study as hard as engineering guys and make more money. Like that's what the dollar system as structured does. That is 100%. Everybody else makes stuff and then they send the money here and we move the money around. And like that system is it's well beyond the end of its useful life. And I say that because like we are doing some things right. But now, again, go back to the first part we talked about. If the Chinese aren't sending rare earth stuff here, that's the hardest part. That's the hardest part. And it takes a long time to sort of build the infrastructure for that. So, we need to go to like Manhattan Project speed on that in terms of, because, it would be a good question for someone to ask Palmer Luckey at Anduril the next time he's doing an interview is, hey, if the Chinese cut off all batteries and all magnets and all rare earth inputs to what you're doing, how many things can you produce a year? And I think I don't think people are going to like the answer. And I say that because we've seen stories over the last 6 to 9 months of like, hey, we tried to build our own batteries for these drones, not from Anduril specifically, but from other people in that supply chain in that world. They said we couldn't do it. We had to buy them from China. They weren't as good. And so it's not there. I think there needs to be some reality around, this right now. I'm still seeing the bargain. We're like, well, fine, we'll just do it ourselves. We're America. We'll just do it ourselves. Yes. But everyone's like, well, just take a year or two. I'm like, so the Chinese did this, China launched, we wrote on Friday, like China launched China 2025 in 2015. And most of Wall Street laughed at them. They're not laughing now. But it took the Chinese with all of the sort of things that they do that we have a hard time doing, right? Centrally planned, some level of, forcing competition, massive subsidies, closed capital account, all the things you have to do that. And it took them 10 years. And we're trying to do something orders of magnitude bigger with less engineers, less workforce. And oh, by the way, an engineering and skilled trades workforce that is like a declining option. In other words, it's a decaying asset because, you know, we got another 6 to 8 years and the last generation that was really in engineering and skilled trades, they're going to be aging out every year. So like we're on the clock and so what else can we do? We have recognized the problem and we are taking some steps. We aren't nearly aggressive enough. We need, you know, I will say we are on the right path. When I'm seeing stories in the Wall Street Journal about welders making $500,000, $600,000 a year coming out of welding school and being able to, and you know what? It's going to be inflationary. It's just so inflationary, which means guess what? The Fed's going to have to put the entire bond market on their books. Great. You know, that's how this has to go. That's what they have to do. And, you know, what's that going to do to the dollar? It's going to get waylaid. Guess what? We offshored this stuff to support the dollar. Why do people think that bringing it back can be done without waylaying the dollar? It's astonishing to me. It's the most like.
When you put it that way, it's very simple. It's like
it's very simple. It's very simple.
And it's, I mean, as you're describing that, I'm just thinking in my mind of how polarized political landscape in the United States is here domestically. And anything Trump tries, even if Trump woke up, he was like, all right, Luke, I hear you. We're going to go do it. The amount of backlash he would get, and he calls for, and calling him like an authoritarian fascist that is.
That's the really challenge, I think, too, yeah. Right? Because this is like an orthogonal, multidisciplinary problem. And that's we, you know, the politics of it, right? Like half of this, you know, without getting into it, like we can't agree on certain scientific facts. Half the country thinks, you know, Dr. What's his name is a national treasure and half think he's not. Half people, you know, the immigration situation is there's no, like we are so polarized. You know, and if you get, you know, if Trump and the Republicans lose the next election, it's still going to be polarized. It's just going to be in the opposite direction. And so that's the other thing too, right? Like people say, we just need to do what we did in 1940. 1940? You had, like, number one, we didn't really have a bunch of foreign engagements. We didn't have a bunch of foreign influence running Washington. We had been basically, like, we had just kind of come on the national stage, number one. So we didn't have a bunch of, like, hey, you can't take that money away from the war you're supporting over here to build a factory base, right? There was no such thing, right? It was all focused here. Number two, you had a huge skilled trade base. And, oh, by the way, 20% of them were unemployed and had been for 10 years. So like if they just needed the rallying cause and we were sort of a very much more unified country, you go, oh yeah, let's go. We can build this. Now it's like apples and zebras, how different all of that is on every angle, politically, domestically. So, you know, again, I think step one is, you know, okay, we admit the problem, but now you got to be realistic, right? It's like, okay, well, I'm 500 pounds and I'm smoking and I have a heart condition. And, you know, people are like, well, we're America. We're just going to go, you know, we're going to run an Ironman next week. And you're like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Like the first step is like, get off the couch, stop smoking, like walk to the sink, make yourself something healthy and walk back. And then next week, if you don't die of a heart attack, then you walk to the mailbox and you come back. And I mean, there's just a time aspect to this that, you know, again, if we don't have a time machine, the time aspect has to be paid.
Yeah. And it almost feels like there needs to be a propaganda campaign, a good propaganda campaign to really introduce the concept of low time preference. And I mean, I think that's the very disconcerting about the current state of America is that we live in a high velocity trash economy where everything is, what did you do for me yesterday? What are you doing for me today? What's your quarterly financial saying? And basically reacting, and then it gets even more distilled to the 24 hour news cycle.
I thought that what Bessent announced about, what was it, 6 month reporting versus quarterly, like a lot of people on Wall Street, like, oh, here comes more fraud. And I actually thought that was a really good idea. That's a really good idea. Like, report every 6 months, report every, like, the amount of effort, having been on the sell side for 15 years investment research, the amount of effort alone that is wasted on quarterly reporting is like mind boggling. You have like the most brilliant minds in America, like reading the release, getting on the call, asking the comment, hey, good quarter, guys. And then like, rather than, hey, here's an idea for raising capital, here's an idea for building a factory, here's like, it's insane. So I thought like, that's a good little baby down payment, but like, you know, it's like, let's keep that going.
Yeah. No, as somebody who sits on the board of a publicly traded company, like the amount of sunk cost or opportunity cost that's spent focusing on quarterly financials is like, you finish the financials for Q1 and then 3 weeks later, it's like, all right, let's start getting the books ready for Q2 earnings.
Yeah, it's not conducive there, right? It's not conducive to like, yeah, because, oh, by the way, as an exec, you know, you go to jail if you sign something that is fraudulent or wrong. And so, like, your first, like, I need to make sure I don't go to jail. Okay. Well, if you're thinking, I got to make sure I don't go to jail, you're not thinking about, how do I compete to Chinese? How do I go into this market? How do I do better in Brazil? How do I, like, these are the real things you got to focus on. And like, we just haven't been for a long time. And it's all, like you said, it's all high time preference society, which is all around, at the end of the day, it's the currency. Why build a factory? Why plan out building a factory? And how do I allocate that capital when the dollar's moving around like this and the cost of that capital? You can't. You can't plan a factory. Come on. You got to have some sort of a better currency system.
No, and I think you did an incredible service to the world a few weeks ago, really pulling on the debasement trade meme and sharing that chart of equities, real estate, and I believe, or it was S&P, NASDAQ, and real estate priced in dollars, gold, and Bitcoin. And I think if we were able to really distill that message like you did and make it popular and have company execs realize like you should be storing your company's profits in these better currencies and Bitcoin and gold.
Oh, like I replied to, so Senator Sanders, Bernie Sanders had something up probably about a month ago. You can find it on my X feed about how, you know, like, I don't know, corporate greed and something else is, you know, the reason why, you know, since 1971, all of the profits, you know, all of the gains from productivity have accrued to the 1% and not to the bottom 50%. And like, I tagged him out. I'm like, with all due respect, Senator Sanders, in 1963, minimum wage in this country was 5 silver quarters. It was $1.25. Minimum wage, $1.25. It's 5 silver quarters. The melt value at $51 of those 5 silver quarters today is like $8 each. So if minimum wage in real money terms was today what it was in 1963, minimum wage would be 5 times $8, would be $40. What is national minimum wage actually? 7.25. You want to know who stole the money, Senator Sanders? It's you and the politicians. You guys changed the currency system. You've been there for however many years he's been there. Change a currency system back. Nixon said it was temporary. That's where it all went. You go from having to pay people $40. You know, imagine if minimum wage was $40. What would wealth inequality be? Corporate profit margins would be a lot lower, sure. But corporate profit dollars would be way higher because we would be running an economy that would be essentially the version of what Henry Ford did initially, right? Which was pay his workers more than the market so that they could buy the Model T's coming off the line. So like that's the fix. That like that's the fix. If they ultimately, unless you fix the currency, you're not gonna really be able to do a whole lot.
No, and it's mind-boggling how many people don't recognize this at all. And I'm looking for a tweet, but there's a guy, Nikita Bear. He just joined Twitter or X as some, he's working on their product I don't know exactly what he's doing, but he tweeted out, he's like, oh, why are all these golden Bitcoin guys are preparing for hyperinflation when AI is extremely deflationary.
I saw that post. I saw that post and it, the answer is very simple. I actually think I replied to him, and I think I just said, deflation is the midwife of hyperinflation in highly levered societies. Yeah. You read the book 1931. In 1931, Germany didn't hyperinflate again because they'd experienced the hyperinflation of 1922. And so they're like, we're not doing that again. But that was one of their choices. It was either default or hyperinflate. And like, I don't think the U.S. is going to nominally hyperinflate. But like, look, the dollar collapsed 90% against oil in 2001. Between 2001 and 2008, right? Oil went from $15 a barrel to $150 a barrel. That is simply the dollar collapsing 90%. The dollar was worth one-tenth as much against oil in 8 years. You know, the Chinese, we say we want to compete. China can make the same or better stuff for us 85% cheaper than us, including things like, you know, Josh Wolf testified to Congress 3 years ago about nuclear power plants. So the Chinese can build a one gig nuke plant for 85% cheaper than the Americans. A gig's a gig. A gig of electricity is a gig of electricity. It's not like there's some special yuan, you know, gig of electricity that gets them more or less power. It's they abide by the same physics. So if their gig of electricity costs 85% cheaper than ours, you know what that tells me? Dollar's 85% overvalued against the yuan. It's that simple. It's the same. That's where this movie's going. Like some version of that. If we want to compete, if we want to break, people say, well, we need to split China. Great. The dollar's got to go down 85%. That's it. Against the yuan. That's fine. Whatever. Good. We'll be able to compete. Working class is going to get paid. Fed's going to have to buy a lot of bonds. But that's where this, like some version of that is where this is going. It's just, it's math. It's double entry bookkeeping. It's not, you know, the only mystery is if we decide to split with China and as everyone's saying we're going to do, we're going to divorce China and redo this. I don't know if it's 85% down or if it's 40% down or it's 60% down, but it ain't friggin' 10% down like we've seen this year. Not even close.
No, it's insane. Too, going back to the Nikita tweet, it's like tech's been deflationary. Like we've had extreme tech deflation over the course of the last six decades specifically. And it's like, yes, TVs are cheaper. What we're doing right now is way cheaper than it would have been 20 years ago. It gets good information out to people. And despite that, the cost of living is rising and there is just this disconnect between that fact and the ability of people to recognize, like, oh, if we paired this with a hard currency, we would actually reap the benefits as a global power and economy if we were able to store our wealth in a hard currency. And we can let prices fall, but the purchasing power of our hard money is going up over time as we're being more productive throughout the economy.
It's that simple, right? People are like, oh, well, gold wasn't so bad for America from 1860 to 1929. America had a pretty good friggin' run. You had this huge productivity, huge technology, right? Technology is not just electric stuff, right? You had trains, you had planes, you had cars, you had all this technology, you had washing machines, consumer goods, massive deflation. And it was highly, highly productive and good for America, good for Americans. We were on a gold standard, and some of it a blended gold silver standard. But that's the challenge. Like, people say this tech is deflationary, and it is. But in the presence of a country with, you know, 7% fiscal deficits at the peak of the economic cycle and 120% debt to GDP and a hollowed out factory base, you know, I've said multiple times, there's nothing more inflationary than an insolvent sovereign that is printing money to keep the nominal value of its sovereign debt high, you know, to keep it nominally money good. And that's why inflation is where it is, despite all this inflationary, you know, deflationary tech, excuse me. It's just they have to keep growing money units because otherwise, you know, the debt implodes. And oh, by the way, the debt imploding is very hyperinflationary. because the debt backs the currency. So if the debt, if the backing of the currency goes to zero or is impaired, guess what happens? That's when you really get a hyperinflation of some description, as people basically dump currency to just get me something that isn't backed by bonds. So yeah, Bitcoin actually does fix this. A gold standard would actually fix this. And you can make the case Bitcoin is able to be, you know, all the things in Bitcoin style, portable and verifiable and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, you need a deflationary currency or else, you know, we're going to kind of continue down this path we're on.
Agreed. In a wrap up, I'll say, like, I think the free market, Bitcoin is a creation of the free market, is beginning to solve this. But I think even any Americans listening to this, you look at things like Square announced last week, where anybody who's running a Square point of sale system throughout the United States will be able to automatically convert a portion of their revenues into Bitcoin right away. And when I think about actually solving this problem, what is the walk to the mailbox for the 500-pound smoker with heart problems? It's like, okay, just if you run a small business and you're using Square, maybe you start by funneling 5% of your revenues into Bitcoin and building a Bitcoin treasury position for your small business. And you see what that does for you over the course of a year, 2 years, 5 years. And then you go, huh, this is better money. And you turn the dial up. And eventually, when I think about ways in which you solve this problem, it's like, all right, let's not depend on the government officials and central bankers who sort of pushed us down this road to think that they're going to solve it themselves or feel the pressure to solve it without any external pressure is a bit wishful, a bit of wishful thinking in my books. We need individual American citizens and businesses to adopt this better money and opt into it. And I think that's how we get through this at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's going to happen. I think it's really encouraging to hear things like that, Square. I mean, it is quickly becoming a matter of utmost importance. I won't go all the way to life and death, but, you know, depending on events, it could become a matter of life and death for businesses to do exactly what you just described, which is just put a little, and individuals, put a little bit into Bitcoin. Because you can see what, you know, the corollary to the Genius Act and the stablecoin gambit to support the treasury market that we talked about earlier is, you're not going to support the stablecoin market, or the stablecoin market's not going to be big enough to support the treasury market with Bitcoin at 200,000 or 500,000. Like, he needs like $1 million Bitcoin, $2 million Bitcoin to pull along the number of stablecoins, to pull along, you know, the T-bill issuance. It basically, you know, we wrote it as, you know, the U.S., the Treasury seems to be standing up Bitcoin de facto as a competing reserve asset to gold. And then they can duke it out. Gold and Bitcoin can duke it out. You know, we'll see. But that's exactly what has to, and that will rebalance things. That will take things away from the financialized guys. That will take power away from the Fed, that will do all the kind of things that you need to. To your point, it's a market, it will be a market-driven incentive system. That will be really, it will narrow wealth inequality. It will, but again, the only way it narrows wealth inequality is if people start buying some every week and self-custody it. Because otherwise, if you don't self-custody it, they're just going to rug pull you like they rug pull, like, you know, you custody it with, you know, you just have to custody it yourself. You just, you know, learn, you know, it's so easy to do. There's very good services that'll help you do it. Like, just do it. Like, just because otherwise you're just re-centralizing it elsewhere. And, you know, it opens up the risk for rug pull down the road.
Yeah. I don't want to glaze them too much, but that's why I'm extremely happy that Square exists and they have the sort of mentality that they do. Now, obviously, Jack's been very vocal about this. Bitcoin is everyday money. We need to use it. And they're supporting many different areas of the industry with, they have BitKey, which is their hardware wallet. They have Proto, which is mining, Spiral, which is open source development, obviously Square and Cash App. And I believe Miles Suter is the product lead. Over a block, a product lead over there said that you'll automatically be able to sweep funds that you accumulate via your Square point of sale terminal to self custody using BitKey and other wallets. And so we need more examples of that, of industry people leading and doing things the right way, because like you said, it is not that hard. And it is important that we do it the right way, because that's how we actually structurally fix these problems.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like, I'm a tech moron. And so like, if I can do it, anybody can do it. Like, I'm like, you know, if the, whatever the tech adoption curve, I'm usually way past the big wave. Like, I'm literally a tech idiot. So like, if it's easy enough for me to do it, just about anybody can do it.
Yeah. And Luke, I appreciate your time. This is a great catch up. I think you've been completely valid. We've been talking on this show, I think, for probably 5 years now. You've just been beating the drum consistently, and it feels like we're hitting an inflection point that you've been pointing to for many years now. So I thank you for your time and educating the audience here.
No, I appreciate that. It's been a great time. It's been fun. It's been the most fun work of my life. And it's been happy to hear from clients and friends this is, this is good. There's times in this business where you don't see the ball that well. And those are when you're trying to work walks and, grind out singles, and, some, when you're seeing the ball well, then, those are the times when it's super fun. And so, hopefully we can, knock on wood, try to keep it going.
Yeah. Highly recommend checking out Forest for the Trees. We'll link to the website, the YouTube channel. I mean, your YouTube video has been great. The Q&A's, if you're looking for quick hits, just to get a peek into what Luke is thinking from a week to week basis, definitely go check that out as well.
Appreciate it.
All right. That's all we got today, freaks. Peace and love.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad free, helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time. And until next time.